Hey, you are listening to The Workplace Leader. This is the podcast where we go behind the scenes of corporate real estate, talking to industry experts about how they shape the next generation workplace. I'm your host, Sabine M., and in today's episode, I'm speaking with Nicola Millard. Nicola is Principal Innovation Partner at BT. Hi, everyone. I'm really excited because this morning I'm with Nicola Millard. I saw a presentation of her at a Future Work Scenarios conference, which was brilliant. And that's why I reached out to have her on the podcast as well. Hi, Nicola.
Hello there. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
That's great to hear. Let's start straight away. I'm really curious, and I hope our audience as well, for what your role at BT is and what your professional background is, because I know that you have kind of an eclectic background with a variety of things that you're vested in.
Yes, eclectic is one word for it. So yes, I work for BT. For those of you who don't know, outside the UK, that's British Telecom. So we're into broadband and networks and all of that lovely stuff. But I always say I'm a slightly weird member of BT because, as you would expect, I am surrounded by some utterly brilliant technologists. But I always say I'm half a technologist because I actually do love technology and I'm fascinated by it. But the other half of me, and I'm never terribly sure if it's top or the bottom half, but is a psychologist. So I'm interested in the people bit. So I'm part of BT's innovation organization as well. BT is a very large investor in research and innovation in the UK. We're in the top 10 investors. I think we've given up figuring out where in the top 10. We're just top 10 now. I think we got to number 3 at one point. So we do a lot of research and innovation. What we're not so good is talking about it. So part of my job most certainly is to raise people's awareness that we do it. I'm actually based in a lovely place called Adastral Park, which is our main research and innovation headquarters. It's just outside Ipswich in the east of England. Obviously, I'm not there at the moment. I'm in my home, as I have been for the past year. But normally, I would be surrounded by some incredible technologists doing, you know, mind-boggling things with things like quantum computing and AI. So I always say I originally was called a futurologist, but I kind of had a love-hate relationship with that job title because everyone always used to ask me if I had a crystal ball. And, you know, if I spent the whole day looking at crystal balls, that would be very boring. And I can also tell you, since someone did very kindly give me a crystal ball, they don't work very well. So I always say I stand on the shoulders of giants because I am surrounded by brilliant people, not just within BT. BT has this incredible innovation ecosystem as well, which spans everything from, you know, startups to our larger tech partners, right the way through to our university partners. And we are incredibly lucky to work with people like MIT, for example, and Cambridge University, and wonderful people like that. So I spend a lot of my time talking to fascinating academics as well in this field. So yeah, I mean, that's my background. I'm a psychologist in a technology company trying to really understand the most disruptive part of innovation, which is, of course, not the technology. It's, of course, us. So yeah, looking at behaviors on both the customer side, so customer behavior, consumer behavior, but also mostly what I'm going to be talking about here is employee behavior in the future of work.
So how you explain to your friends and family as well what you do, that you don't have the crystal ball, but get to talk to a lot of people?
Yeah, that's always very difficult because everyone always asks me, you know, about their telephone bill and they find out I work for BT. So yeah, I don't do that bit. No, I mean, I always say I'm just basically a researcher looking at behaviors and how people relate to technology and why they accept it or reject it. And also the broader strategic ripple backs, I guess, on what technology does for business. So that's kind of how I try and explain it without mentioning crystal balls too much.
Yeah. Don't put the idea in the head, it will stick.
I know, that's the trouble.
As an innovation partner, who are your stakeholders then? You say you do the research. Who are you working with?
Sure. So I am part of our enterprise business. So although BT is very well known as a home broadband provider and we do mobile and all of that lovely stuff, actually, we also serve business clients around the world. So I always say I innovate with and for those business clients. So we're talking typically larger corporates in the UK and globally, and also public sector in the UK as well. So I describe my role as speed dating. So obviously, you know, I do my own research and also liaise with a ton of other researchers within BT and also in our ecosystem. And obviously I talk to a lot of customers as well. So it's really trying to understand, you know, what their challenges are and where their issues are, and try to innovate with them and try and corral, you know, the incredible people that we can to try and solve some of those problems. So yes, my job is speed dating fundamentally.
I think you should say that next time someone asks you what you do. I'm speed dating professionally.
Absolutely. Yes.
Now, I can imagine that coming with the newest research and ideas, it's not always finding welcoming arms. Are there typical challenges you're facing?
Well, I always say, I mean, firstly, in innovation, we know that most of it fails. So that's the first thing. That's always the challenge around, you know, trying to combat cultures that are very afraid of failure, because actually failure can be a very good thing. Obviously, it can be an incredibly bad thing as well. But I think if you fail and learn from that failure, and it's not too much of a disaster, that's, you learn what not to do. I always say that. So I'm a huge fan of things like innovation and experimentation. And I think certainly in the future world of work, which is what occupies a fair portion of my life at the moment, I think we're getting into that sort of situation where experimentation is absolutely vital, but we need to learn from failure. So I think, you know, first, the risk averse piece can be interesting for operational people because they are usually very risk averse, whereas innovation people, yeah, we know we're probably going to fail. But if we can fail fast and learn from that failure and then succeed fast, I always say that that's a good thing. So that's the first thing. I mean, I think with the future world of work now, it's quite interesting. I've been doing projects around the future of work since, to be honest, the very beginning of my career with BT, which one of my first jobs in BT was back in 1992. Obviously, I was about six at the time. But my first project was our very first home working experiment back in the 90s. We were trying home working. And this was an exciting project because it was a traditional experiment. We did it for a year. We got some volunteer. Actually, they were call center advisors to work from home for a whole year. They were up in Scotland, in Inverness. Hence, it was called the Inverness Experiment. And we learnt an awful lot, but it was an experiment, so it was bounded. It was only ever going to be a year. And it's quite interesting that, you know, that experiment largely did succeed. I would say the thing it failed on was the fact that the technology really wasn't there to support home working. So the first thing we had to do was, we didn't have broadband at that point, or 4G or 5G or any of those lovely connectivity technologies that we have today. We literally had to bulldoze people's front gardens in order to dig a hole to get a big pipe into their house to support all of the voice and data that they needed. We put video conferencing in. Now, it was terrible video conferencing. The unit, for a start, was about the size of a refrigerator. And the quality was terrible. So it was all pixelated and your mouth moved and then the sound came out about 5 minutes later. So it tended to give people a headache. But we were very sensitive then around, were people going to be isolated in their homes? How could we reintroduce an element of human contact? So we thought the problem through very thoroughly. But I'd always been a bit frustrated. I think when people, about 5 years ago, I think someone asked me, probably on a podcast, in fact, what one of my biggest predictions that had failed, what was the biggest one? And I said, well, I thought home working was going to take off a lot more than it was than it had. And of course, then the pandemic arrived and home working became the norm for a fair proportion of us, those of us that were lucky enough to transition to home working. So I guess my challenge now is people are embracing new ideas at the moment, which is brilliant. And I always say, you know, innovation out of a crisis. Will you innovate your way out of a crisis, frankly? So that there is certainly an appetite for innovation amongst our customers at the moment. And I think it really, there's starting to become a much, much more of a culture of experimentation in terms of how we come out of this pandemic, blinking into the light and figure out, how we can get work working better for everybody. And I think, you know, it was obvious before the pandemic that the future of work was not home working, and the future of work wasn't permanent office working either. It was always going to be a combination. I think the interesting challenge we have now is to try and figure out what worked in the pandemic, what didn't work in the pandemic, what almost worked in the pandemic. And that's the intriguing bit, the almost worked bit. And then how can we potentially redesign work to make it better, as I said, for the organization and for the individuals within it?
Do you see the workplace changing already?
Yeah, I do. I mean, to be honest, the change had started prior to the pandemic. So I think pretty much every customer I talked to prior to the pandemic had a digital workplace program in play, including BT itself. So everyone was talking about the digital workplace. And that was, I mean, as a researcher, my frustration, and always as an academic, you have to go, well, what is a digital workplace? How do we define a digital workplace? And obviously, most people tended to define it by the technology. And to be honest, you know, the technology has enabled us to work in very different ways prior to the pandemic, oddly enough. So it's almost, if there was ever a perfect technological time for a pandemic, this was probably it, because we've got the convergence of cloud technologies. We've got an immensely rich set of collaboration technologies. And we also have the connectivity that we didn't have back in 1992. So all of those things have come together really to underpin that shift in the ways that we were working. But I think in terms of the digital workplace, it's much broader than the technology. The technology just enables it. So we did some research, and we've done research over the years on this, really looking at the priorities of business leaders, particularly when they were going into a digital workplace program. The fundamental thing that we wanted to ask them was, what do you want to get out of a digital workplace? Because, you know, there must be a reason you're doing this. And the reasons have been fairly consistent, although, again, when we look at the sort of top 10 reasons, they ebb and flow. But the number one has always been consistent. So it's to improve productivity. So that's obvious. If you're going to reinvent work, let's reinvent it to be more rather than less productive. Now, I think there are some questions about productivity that maybe we'll touch on in a minute. But so that's the number one thing that we found that business leaders wanted. The number two was to improve customer experience. And of course, I always link customer experience and employee experience, because I think it's very, very difficult to get a good customer experience if you have a bad employee experience. So the two really do go hand in hand. And then the third one really is around, and this one went up in the priorities quite rapidly during the pandemic, was to enable remote working. So that's what we want to get out of the digital workplace. But I think things like productivity, you probably need to rethink productivity for the digital world. I think the issue that we have is that we tend to measure the things that we've always measured. And those, I mean, productivity measures typically were forged in the heat of the Industrial Revolution. And a lot of those measures are around factory measures, effectively. So it's all about ratios of inputs and outputs. And it assumes that those outputs are, you know, tangible. I'm not manufacturing widgets as a knowledge worker. So what is my output? And I think, you know, the large proportion of people that were lifted and shifted into home working were knowledge workers. And knowledge workers are incredibly difficult to measure, because we don't produce anything particularly tangible. We produce things like ideas. So although you can measure input, so I can measure how many meetings I've done in a day, I can measure how long I work, I can measure whether I'm in an office or not, none of those are actually particularly relevant measures for my outputs. And I think that's what we struggle with, particularly when we discuss things like, have people been more productive at home? Well, in some senses, probably yes, but actually in traditional senses, maybe no, because we're seeing working days extend by about 50 minutes a day. And actually, if you work longer by traditional productivity measures, productivity goes down. Actually, if you work significantly longer, productivity goes down largely because you burn out. So I think, you know, that's one thing we need to rethink. And then we get into this realm of hybrid working, which is what everyone is now talking about. Forget digital. That's so last year. It's now hybrid. It's all about the hybrid. And I think the problem with hybrid is that, again, I want to define what it is. And I think most people, when I ask them, they define flexible working, not hybrid working. So they're talking about the number of days in an office. Now, my favorite hybrid is the Zadonk, which is a combination of a zebra and a donkey. I can tell you that particular creature does not spend 3 days a week as a zebra and 2 days a week as a donkey. It is a completely separate creature. It is a different breed. And that's where I think hybrid, I think it's a very different breed of working. It's a new way of working. And it basically, my definition of it is it untethers you from both time and place. And it's all about the employee experience as well. So it's irrelevant where you work. You should be able to access work wherever you happen to be. So because you then untie work from time and place, you completely render things like the number of hours worked and whether you're in an office. All of those kind of traditional measures are irrelevant in a hybrid workplace. So, you know, I think hybrid challenges a lot of the traditions of the workplace. But again, it's a digital first hybrid, I think, because the common platform, the common ground, if you like, is digital rather than physical.
How does that go together, though, with loads of corporations having these, I don't want to say rules, but guidelines onto, we expect you to be in the office like a day or two, at least in the week or at least in the month. I mean, there's different rulings out there, but they're looking at guidelines mostly.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the key here is choice. So we're all different in terms of individuals. We all have different jobs. We all have different tasks. We will all work in teams differently. So I think it largely is around devolving a lot of those decisions right the way down, firstly to the individual, but also to the team, around how does the team work? Because actually the important thing is work. It's the work, not the place of work, that's important. And I think that's what we need to get over. It's work that's important. So it's kind of irrelevant where I am. If I want to be in an office, if that's the way that I work best, yes, I should probably be in an office. And I know home working hasn't worked for everybody. I mean, typically the data shows a 70-30 split. So 70% have actually adapted fine, 30% have not. Typically the ones that have not tend to skew slightly younger. So we're looking at a younger workforce. Now, there are a few reasons for that. Firstly, housing. If you're younger, the likelihood is, unless you're very lucky, you might not have a room where you can shut yourself away and be quiet and work alone. You're probably in a shared house. I know a lot of graduates I was talking to had actually moved back with their parents during the pandemic. So they had to cope with their parents around as well. So, you know, not necessarily ideal as a workplace. And obviously, you know, with kids around too, if you were homeschooling, that, I mean, we are seeing quite a lot of research around women being very much more highly impacted by the pandemic than men, because typically they were also having to homeschool as well as work. So there's been a lot of, you know, things that are really problematic around home working. But this wasn't home working as normal, I hasten to add. So we're seeing it skew younger. Also, I think the other reason is that if you're new to an organization or you're at the beginning of your career, building networks is very important. And that's easier to do in a physical space than it is in virtual space. So I think, you know, having an office there and having the choice to go to one is great. And I think most of us are sitting there going, well, I don't want to be at home all the time. So I think choice is the absolute key here. But I think a lot of the companies I'm working with now are being less prescriptive around, well, you have to be in the office 2 days a week, and more devolving it down to a decision that's made between the team leader and the individual, depending on what they're doing. And I think that's sensible, because then it reintroduces that choice factor. And actually, from a psychological perspective, if you have a job with high demand and low control and low choice, typically the output is stress. So I think that's been one of the problems with the pandemic, is because we've had very little choice. As those choices open up, hopefully at some point, we can then choose where, when we work. And obviously that, you know, it could be home, it could be the office, it could be the coffice. I like to call co-working spaces coffices, because basically, I live on coffee. So I need a good cup of coffee in front of me to work effectively. But I think hub working is a particularly interesting one, whether that's, you know, a coffee shop or a hotel or a more formal workspace. Although I have to say, the Irish have got the right idea. They just published a remote working manifesto looking to open up a network of rural pubs as well as co-working spaces. I'm not entirely sure I'd be that productive in a poffice, but it's a great idea around, can you start to introduce something where you can get out of the house? You don't have a 2 hour commute into a central office. Obviously, you know, we've got to think about things like the climate crisis as well. So long commuting is probably not what we should be encouraging. But if we do want to get out of the house and have an active commute, can we go somewhere that's within a bicycle ride or a walk away? So I think all of those provide various choices for employees to work. But ultimately, the important thing is what we output, what we actually achieve in the workplace rather than necessarily where we work.
There's still a lot of change in mindsets necessary that this is broadly accepted, unfortunately. I love the pub idea from the Irish. Actually, I was talking with a colleague just this week because we regularly look at utilization data across our customers. And in London, utilization has not really picked up. It's still very low, at 10% or something across the board. And he was like, "But why is that? I mean, the pubs are open." And I was like, "Well, obviously, the offices need to be more like pubs because that's the experience that draws consumers."
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think that social function of the office is the one thing that we've really missed, haven't we, during the pandemic? Because we are social creatures. And again, this discussion had started prior to the pandemic as well, because I think we'd realized that, if you want to do concentrated work, the office is not always the best place to go. Obviously, if you don't have another place where you can concentrate, you do go to an office, but largely the office performs a social function. So I'd always said, prior to the pandemic, it was evolving into a collaboration tool. And if you think about designing a collaboration tool, you probably wouldn't design the traditional open plan office, which is, to be frank, designed for capacity, not for collaboration, and can be a horrible distraction machine if you are trying to do concentrated work because everyone is socializing around you. And yeah, that's why everyone sort of puts earphones on and tries to. I'm an introvert as well. I always say you can spot an introvert in an office because they've generally built a wall of books around themselves and they've got earphones on, so you can spot them. But I think the office as a social function, I think, is a very differently designed office. So it is about communication, it's about collaboration. And I think during the pandemic, I think there's been a growing realization that it's a place where we build community as well. So there's a community function of offices that needs to be fulfilled. But that's a very different office to that sort of traditional view of an office. And I think I'd become completely obsessed by office designs prior to the pandemic. I've been lucky enough to travel around the world and see some amazing office spaces and just think, wow, I could really see myself working in here. But yeah, there were lots of really interesting ideas. And I think, effectively, the home is now a competitor to the office, if you like, because I've got a great home setup now. I know I can work from home, but I can't really socialize from home. So if I want to socialize, whether it's with customers or with colleagues or with my team, the likelihood is I want to be in an office and I want a space that when I am in an office, I want to know that other people I know are in there. I have the right facilities to do what I need. So there's a lot of stuff around how do we provide a lot more information about those office spaces so that we can manage capacity. I think the hybrid workplace requires a lot of coordination. And obviously, we can then bring in things like smart buildings, the Internet of Things, AI. We call it a digital fabric. So basically, underlying it is the network. And then you layer on a number of technologies that will help people to navigate their ways through an office, meet people and socialize and build community with technology helping, hopefully.
Actually, it brings me to my next question. I wanted to ask you what you see as the enablers for the future of work and this hybrid concept. And at the same time, I was just thinking when you said that technology is much better than 1992 when you did that experiment. At the same time, it's still not frictionless. And oftentimes we revert back, like it's a little failure if we can't get to technology to work. I know it was always a nightmare for me to go into a meeting where I had people on screen and off screen in the room, and then you needed to get the technology work, a lot of stress. And then, of course, it didn't work. And yeah, always a compromise then in the end.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're all very reliant on the technology, aren't we? So it's starting to get better in terms of the frictionless. Certainly, it's much less frictionless than it was in 1992. I mean, I think that's where I like to bring in the concept of the horrible hybrid, because I think there are going to be quite a lot of those. And I think, not all of it's about the technology. Some of it's around the culture. And I think to get this to work, we really do need to rethink culture. So the most obvious horrible hybrid that nearly everyone everyone has experienced, is the one where you've got a meeting where half the people are in physical space and half of the people are remote. And the problem there often is that although, you know, you're beaming in, the people that are remote are often on video or maybe on audio, because they're out of sight, they're out of mind. We know that during the pandemic that actually digital has been a great leveler, because if you're all in a little square in a box, everyone can see you and you can be heard. So that works. It obviously, you know, it's not absolutely perfect. There are issues around endless video conferences, and I'll touch on that in a minute because that's another horrible hybrid. But you know, I think somebody actually came up with a great thing last week, was that their rule of thumb basically was it's either all Room or it's all Zoom. Obviously, other providers are available as well, but you can't rhyme a lot with Teams. That's the trouble. But yeah, basically, it's a digital first hybrid. So if you have people that are split within physical and digital space, the common ground is digital. So everyone is on video conferencing. So I think that that's a change in culture. Obviously, you know, those meetings need to be chaired well as well. I think that's another thing. But I think that the meeting culture is one that we've really got to tackle, because that's a major horrible hybrid. And I think everyone is now complaining about Zoom fatigue. And I always say I get up every morning with an impending sense of Zoom now, because I know that I've probably got scheduled an endless flow of 30 to 60 minutes. Meetings. And that's not productive for a start. I think there's been some fascinating stuff done by the likes of Microsoft around the effect of that on your brain. It's not good, by the way. If you don't take any breaks between your meetings, it's really not good on a number of levels. Now, that to me is not a problem with the technology. The technology is doing what it says it should do on the tin, effectively. It's a problem with meetings. And I think admittedly, there during the pandemic, we've seen that there seemed to be an increased need for coordination. So let's have a meeting to coordinate without maybe thinking, maybe this doesn't actually need to be a meeting. And we know from, you know, remote first companies that they tend to do a lot more of their coordination asynchronously. They're very much more written cultures. So they'll be using, you know, the asynchronous collaboration tools like chat, like shared spaces, like email to coordinate stuff. And then when they need to make a real-time decision, that's the point at which they come together and have a meeting. They also often have the concept of office hours. So rather than having, you know, a solid block of meetings from 8 o'clock in the morning to 6 o'clock at night, they'll have office hours, which may be 11 till three. And you only have synchronous meetings during those times, which means that you can do other work in other times. And, you know, I think that's sensible rather than I know some companies now are looking at Zoom free Fridays, for example. That just moves the problem to Monday to Thursday. So you end up with endless meetings, really, really solid meetings Monday to Thursday. And then phew, and Friday, I can actually do stuff. That's not what you should be doing. You should be maybe rethinking this traditional analog concept of a meeting and saying, well, should this just be lifted and shifted into digital space? Or can we do this in very different ways?
Something that we, our team has taken on as well, now that we challenge each other. And do we really need to meet on that? Can we discuss this in our chat function? Can that be a call? Can we work on it separately? Yeah, because yeah, you end up being on Zoom the whole day and sometimes even in the evening when you socialize like that with your friends as well, depending Indeed. On how strict regulations are. Now, we touched on productivity earlier as something that's hard to measure. Another thing that strikes me as hard to measure is actually employee experience. You may tell me it's not, but I think a lot of companies have not so far measured it continuously, at least. So the question is, how can they do that? How can they turn that around and actually look at more human-centric metrics and a more human-centric workplace in the end?
Yeah, I mean, I think... I can bore for about measures for hours. And I always say, you know, generally what we need to do as organizations is probably not have one single measure, but have a suite of basket of measures of things that we probably need to improve as well. So I've done a lot in the customer experience space about this. So I have a firm belief that you can't have one net promoter score and run everything from that. It's similar with the employee experience space. There isn't one score. There's a whole ton of things that you need to think about. And you can use those as different levers to improve things for employees. So I think the first thing is, figure out what you want to measure, what you probably want to improve from an employee experience perspective, and then ask employees fairly regularly, although not on a daily basis, because you then get, you know, fatigue around being asked questions all the time. So the measures are very difficult. I think when you get into what should we be measuring around the digital workplace or the hybrid workplace, there's lots of ideas flying around. I know, you know, measuring employee well-being is an increasingly popular idea. In fact, you know, it's even being scaled up to a country level. So I know countries like Iceland and New Zealand and Scotland are talking about having productivity measures on a national level that are much more engaged with well-being. So I think, you know, well-being is an interesting one. How you measure it, well, again, that's a discussion that you could have as to what metrics you use. I think one of the more fascinating ones, which is much more conceptual, particularly around knowledge workers, is around, well, what do knowledge workers actually output? And ideally, they should output ideas. So I think actually trying to understand how ideas flow is a really interesting concept around how can you gauge how ideas flow around an organization. Now, particularly I'm in an innovation space, so it's very important because that's my primary output is ideas. Now, oddly enough, the science of epidemics and the science of idea flow are very similar, actually. So a pandemic is a very good example of how ideas potentially could flow around an organization, albeit a slightly, you know, more negative way of looking at it. But, you know, how do ideas flow? And how can I measure where those ideas go and how those ideas are mobilized? That's what the fantastic Michael Schrager at MIT is talking about at the moment on a conceptual level. I think when it comes down to how do you actually measure that, much more difficult, because I can very easily measure inputs, how many meetings, who I've met with, but how do I actually then start to track those ideas? Now, obviously, the data is probably there somewhere within the network, but we need to start to mine it and understand how those ideas flow better in order to maybe, you know, look back at productivity in a very people-centered way to say, how do people actually contribute to the productivity of this business? And how do we engage them? Because they need to be engaged with purpose. They need to know their role in that purpose, and they need to know their contribution. We know that from some of the fantastic stuff we've been doing around morale within BT. Some of my colleagues have been doing some great research around morale. So yeah, all of those things are very important to maintain employee morale.
Now, I said the sentiment's there, the technology's there. Still, in the past years at least, I mean, you said earlier, you noted that home working did not take off as you would have expected. And the same way in the corporate real estate organizations, a lot of the tools are not being used or have not been used in the past. Is there a reason why you think that is, why they're lagging behind in that digital transformation?
Specifically on real estate, I think the model of, I guess, that capacity piece is very much the driver in the real estate space. So how many people can I get into X amount of space tends to be the traditional way of looking at real estate within office spaces. And I think that that's got to change. Again, it's metrics. So I could get lots of people in there, but they're not particularly productive, and it might not be a great space to work in either. So I think it does link back into what we just talked about. So how do we start to introduce a number of different metrics? And that requires you to understand, well, firstly, who is in the building? What are they doing? How do you support the tasks that they're doing? How do you then make that kind of that instrumentation, you know, what rooms are available, what spaces are available? Can I pre-book it? But can I be flexible enough so that if I book it 3 weeks in advance and then forget about it, can somebody else use that space? So again, a lot of it's to do with how we measure it, how we open up the data sets within the buildings, and how we create those incredible spaces. I mean, there are some incredible office spaces out there. And I think increasingly we're seeing, talking to some of my contacts in the real estate market, they're sort of saying, well, it's the luxury buildings that are going, it's the fairly tatty ones that are not. In fact, I mean, in BT's strategy at the moment, we're closing a lot of our very old buildings. And I have always commented that in the history of BT buildings, typically our buildings were created for technologies. So we used to have, you know, very big racks of network technologies in our buildings. So we didn't need windows. And then we moved all of the racks of technology out and we put people in there. And they're not very nice buildings. And we've realized that. So actually, a lot of those buildings are going, and we're lucky enough to have a number of buildings that are still being built. Actually, our new headquarters in London is just still being built. But they're really emphasizing, let's get some really good buildings that are really nice to work in so that people actually want to work in them in the first place. So I think, you know, the building bit, I think, is an interesting bit. Then overlay the culture bit, which I think is probably more, you know, where you look at the behaviors. I think, and we've seen research on this, that prior to the pandemic, this out of sight, out of mind thing can be a big problem. So that the proximity bias that we tend to have, you know, instinctively, if we see people, our inner caveman is used to trusting people we see. So if you don't see people, which is more typical in a remote workplace and a hybrid workplace, there is an anxiety that you might not get promoted and you might not get a good appraisal if you're not seen to be in the office. So I think this is the other challenge around hybrid working. So there's a leadership challenge. You can't lead by walking around, although one could argue that that's not a good way of leading anyway. But I think we've had leadership by zooming around now. Again, other providers are available, but there have been good and bad parts of that. So we maybe miss out on the sort of everyday body language and the serendipity. But I think one of the more refreshing things about the pandemic is I think I've met all of my team's families now, you know, husbands, wives, children, cats, dogs, because they've all wandered into shot at some point during the pandemic. And that's actually made, I think, work a little bit more personal. You're not just seeing the office persona of the person, you're seeing them more as a whole person. So I think there's been a good aspect to that. But I think that the challenge on hybrid, and again, this could be a horrible hybrid, is that if you don't see work, you've got to make that invisible work visible. And again, that requires transparency. So how can you, if you are working remotely, raise the profile of work, raise the profile of what you're doing without people actually necessarily seeing you on a daily basis? So that's another big challenge, I think, that we have.
Now, with all the challenges mentioned, if you could have one wish for the future of work to magically solve a problem for the workplace, what would it be?
I think I've already said it. Let's focus in on the work rather than the place or the time. I think we need to really focus in on good work as well. And I think in the context of more and more automation and AI, which of course was supposed to be the big disruptor for the future of work, but actually wasn't, it's still around. But if you look at AI and automation, typically what AI and automation does is it takes away all of the routine, transactional, boring, mundane stuff where there's a whole load of data, there's loads of rules, there's loads of processes. Often that's quite boring work. It's also very measurable, which is one of the interesting challenges, but it leaves us as human beings with the chaos, the complexity, the stuff that requires empathy and caring, the stuff that actually makes us very uniquely human. And I don't see it as a robo-Armageddon situation, because I think although there is some overlap with some of those boring transactional tasks that machines are good at doing, I don't think there's a huge amount of overlap between the human and the machine. So I've always said this isn't about artificial intelligence, this is about augmenting intelligence. The trouble, of course, is that the humans, because we take on the complex stuff and the emotive stuff, it's also the hard to measure stuff. So under traditional productivity measures, the machines look really productive and we look hopelessly unproductive. And yet we add immense amounts of value. We just can't necessarily measure that value under traditional measures. So I think that's why we need to just prioritize work, because I think increasingly we are going to see a lot more automation and we should see a lot more automation, because actually a lot of the jobs that are ripe for automation are not necessarily great jobs. And yet, you know, most jobs are like jigsaw puzzle pieces that you don't see entire jobs necessarily wiped out by that automation. You just see individual jigsaw puzzle pieces being wiped out. And then hopefully it leaves us with the more human stuff to do, which then means we need to make sure that our employees are engaged and supported because they're doing quite a hard task. So I think there's a lot of, just focus in on good work. Let's try and create good work rather than necessarily get so hung up on where does that work happen and how many hours do I work.
When you said AI and machine learning, I just popped into my head that predictive analytics is something that's discussed a lot now as the savior for the future. Do you think there can be some truth in that, to bridge the gap through predictions, or are we not predictable?
To a certain extent, we're not predictable. And I think, so particularly in the customer space I look at, I think this gets quite fascinating because I call it a me economy, because these things, AI does not work by magic, sadly. It works by data. And a lot of that data is my data. And unless I share my data, it can't work. And under things like GDPR, for example, I have to actually actively give my consent for you to have that data. And I think therein lies the problem. Because if I'm not willing to share my data, the AI does not work. So there has to be this me economy piece. So I need to see some advantage. Now, as a customer, you know, I'm not going to share my data unless you personalize the experience for me. Or maybe you tell me the stuff that I probably would have needed to tell you, but it's quite nice, you know, being more proactive rather than reactive. Tell me stuff I need to know before I need to tell you is actually really good. Then the predictive stuff can get a bit creepy actually in the customer space. So if it starts to predict my behavior before I know that behavior is going to happen, I get creeped out. It will depend on what it is, but I might get creeped out. And at that point I go, oh no, that's too creepy. You're not having my data. And I think the same is applicable to the employee space. So if employees are going to share their data, obviously there may be a contractual obligation to share some of that data from a security perspective. But to be very open and transparent in an organization, I need to see some advantage to that sharing. So does it personalize that experience? Does it make it more friction-free? Does it enable me to have proactive stuff? And then the predictive stuff when it's there, if it makes my life easier, yeah, brilliant. If it's creepy, absolutely no way. So I think there's a really fine line as we go into smart buildings, smart cities, smart homes, IoT, edge technologies. There's a real big challenge around the behavioral piece around, well, why would I have that on in the first place? Because the danger then is I'll have a smart everything, but I
think there's this case study building in Amsterdam as well, where they built in like everything that is possible. And then actually the occupiers don't like it because I want to be able to open the window by myself and put the shutter down when I want it and not when the building thinks it's most intelligent to do it. So it did fail there. So yeah, we like control as well.
We do. Control is a very basic motivation. So yeah, lack of control, as I said, can cause stress. So so yeah, if the machines take over and take control,
well, Nicola, it's been really great to have you on. I really loved this conversation. Got so much out of it. Thank you for taking the time. I'm not going to keep you longer. You can go back to the coffee.
Oh yes, I need my coffee.
Thanks for listening. If you have enjoyed this episode of The Workplace Leader, there's more. Go visit our blog and have a look at some of the other topics we have covered. We have just released a study on corporate real estate in Europe that you can download. Or tune into our next episode of The Workplace Leader.